And we are now recording. So welcome everybody to Global Math Department. My name is Jessica Bogey and I'm your host this evening. Tonight we are going to hear from Matt Lane all about the hidden math in video games. Can everyone take a moment right now to introduce themselves in the chat window? Take some time and tell us what you teach, where you teach, and what your Twitter handle is, if you have one, so we can follow some new people. Welcome, Brandy. And Joe. Casey, I know nothing either except for Contra and a bunch of Nintendo games when I was little.
That's all you need.
That's all I need, Contra.
Yeah, you'll be
up,
fine.
Up, down, down, left, right, left, right. Yes, Jackie. All right, everybody else, where are you all from? Middle school, sixth grade. Hi, Nancy. Tetris, yes. Super Mario. Hi, Debbie. Pong, yes. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for joining. Oh, that's awesome, Joe. That's actually really good. I should add one to my breakout, too. Hi, Michael. Thanks for joining us. Hi, Peter. And all you need is Zelda. Yes, that's a good one, too. All right, so I'm going to get started now. So before I turn this over to Matt and we stop reminiscing all about our video game history, let me explain a little bit about how our Global Math Department meetings work. They are recorded, and they are typically available, I would say, a few hours, but at the max, 24 hours after the meeting ends. To view the recording or to share the recording with someone who wasn't able to view it, all you have to do is come back to the same URL you came to this evening. So it makes it really easy to share with someone in an email, let them know, hey, tonight was awesome. You've got to watch this. The Global Math Department community prides itself on being very friendly and supportive. So we do have the chat room available for topical and general conversation throughout the meeting. Matt will probably stop a little bit here and there to catch your questions. I will also try and catch some of them for him, just in case we need to get those answered for you. So our speaker tonight is Matt Lane, and it's all yours, Matt.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. Let me know if any of y'all can't hear me or if there are any technical difficulties. Quick background on me. Most of you probably know me from Mathalicious, where I worked for a few years after I finished my graduate degree in mathematics. Since then, I've switched gears a bit, and now I teach web development in San Francisco, but my first love is always math. So tonight, I'd like to talk about math, obviously, but from a perspective that I hope everyone will find interesting and engaging. And I've given this talk a few times before, but never remotely. So we'll see how this goes. So typically what I do when I give this talk in person is I have people pair up and we do a quick icebreaker where we just play a very simple coin game. Two people have a coin, they take turns flipping it. One person takes heads, the other takes tails. Whoever wins the flip gets a point, and the first to 5 points wins. I don't think it's really feasible for us to pair off in this setting. So what I thought I would try to do is share my screen and use this website called justflipacoin.com to sort of mimic mimic this competition. So can everybody see my screen? There's the remnants of my previous flip, which was a tails. Hang on, I'm just going to hop over. Cool, looks like people can see. All right, so I'm just going to flip this coin a few different times. I will take tails, and the audience will be heads, and we'll see what happens. So here's our first flip. Tails, sweet. Looks like I'm up 1-0. Heads, okay. 1-1. Heads, 2-1. Okay. I'm going to stop it there. Typically what I do is I stop the game while people are in the middle of it. People are usually frustrated by this, but it's for the greater good, which I will talk about momentarily. So imagine that, well, you don't have to imagine. I stopped the game before we had declared a winner, right? And at the point I had stopped the game, everyone else was beating me 2-1. No big deal. It's a pretty simple little game. We didn't have anything riding on it. But now I'd like you to imagine that we'd put money on the line. So maybe I had put some amount of money in the pot. And to keep things simple, let's imagine that one of you had put money in the pot. And it was a sort of winner take all. So if I won, I got the pot. If the audience won, that person in the audience who had put in money takes everything from the pot. But I interrupted the game before a winner was declared. And so something I'd like you to think about, and we can chat about it for a couple minutes here in the chat window, is how should we split the pot if the game gets interrupted before there's a winner? And I have two specific examples here. One actually happened, right? What happens if heads is winning 2-1? Or 4-2, or 3-0. It doesn't matter. And I'm not looking for like a mathematically precise answer here. I'm just looking for some things that come to your mind when you think about sort of what's a fair way to split that pot if the game gets interrupted before we can determine a winner. Okay. Nice. So let's just say, you know, it doesn't matter how much we put up, but we both put in the same amount. So if I put in $5, you also put in $5. If I put in $10, you also put in $10. So we each put in the same amount, whatever that amount is. Okay, cool. So I'm seeing a couple people say 50-50, give the money back. So no winner means, you know, we should just take what we put in and call it a day is what it sounds like. Start again. Cool. Anybody else have any other ideas? Split into portions by game. Okay. Yeah. So maybe we, interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah. So split into portions by game. So maybe, you know, we set aside a certain amount of money for each point and split it based on that. Nice one, Michael. Cool. So I want to talk about this, this game sort of historically. So conventional thinking around sort of the mid 15th century was that you should split the pot in proportion to, the split of points. In other words, for both of these examples, whether heads was winning 2-1 or 4-2, in both of those cases, heads has twice as many points as tails. And so heads should take twice as much of the winnings. And then that would be a fair division of the pot. But if you think about it for a little bit longer, that doesn't make a ton of sense, because if heads is winning 4-2, heads was really only one point away from winning when the game got interrupted. So in some sense, heads was much closer to winning in the second example than the first. And one way to think about sort of fair division of the pot is to imagine all possible outcomes if the game had been allowed to continue. So let's break that out in the second example, because there are fewer outcomes to put into a table. So if heads is up 4-2 when the game is interrupted, were the game allowed to continue, only four possible things could have happened, right? So if the game had been allowed to continue, it's possible that the next flip would have come up heads, in which case heads would have won with a 50% probability. Or had the game been allowed to continue, we could have gotten a tails and then a heads, in which case heads still would have won. And y'all can see the table and see the other possible outcomes. Because heads is only one point away from winning, it turns out that heads is much more likely to win had we allowed the game to continue. So just from this table, we can see that were the game allowed to continue, heads wins, you know, roughly 7 times out of every 8. And so from this perspective, you can argue that a fair division of the pot when the game is interrupted is for heads to take $7 for every dollar that tails takes. And if you compare this to the scenario where heads is up 2-1, the scenario we were in, that second scenario is a bit more complicated because there are many more future outcomes, but you can do the same sort of analysis. And in that case, you find that the pot split is much closer to 2-1, although not exactly there. So this problem has a name, as you can see from the top of the slide. It's called the problem of points. Keith Devlin actually wrote a whole book about a set of letters between Pascal and Fermat, in which they talked about this problem and came up with the solution that I described in that last slide, where you think about all the possible future outcomes. Devlin argues in his book that this was sort of like the dawn of what we now know of as probability theory. So concepts like expected value weren't really part of sort of the mathematical vernacular at that time. And Pascal and Fermat really sort of developed a lot of these fundamental concepts through this sequence of letters. So I usually start with that example just because I want to talk about games. And I think I have to play a little bit of defense at first in terms of why bother talking about games at all. And so the first thing I just want to highlight is the fact that games have a precedent. Even silly little games like the problem of points, right? It's just a coin flip game. It's nothing sophisticated or fancy. But there's a lot of really interesting, rich mathematics to be found there just from asking sort of the right questions. Two other things I want to talk about, which I'll get to momentarily, the relevancy of games and their value for learning. So I want to hit these three points. This next part of the talk will be a little bit higher level, a bit more academic, but once I've highlighted these points, then we'll get into the fun stuff and take a look at a few examples. So this is where we'll be for the next, I don't know, 45 minutes or so. Yes, Joe, I agree. I'll talk more about that right now. relevancy, let's talk about it. There are a few different studies that you can look to for gaming demographic information. The Pew Internet Project released a report in 2008 with some stats, and the Entertainment Software Association releases a report every year. Yeah, I see people are already reading the stats. But these numbers are certainly, I play games, but they surprised even me. 97% of teenagers play video games. Half play video games as recently as yesterday. 75% play at least once a week. 31% play at least once a day. That includes mobile games, right? So it's not necessarily true that all of these teenagers have Xboxes or PlayStations or whatever, but they do all play games. Well, most of them anyway. 63% of U.S. households have at least one person who plays video games for 3 or more hours per week. Games aren't simply the domain of teenage boys, right? 31% of game players are adult women, compared to only 17% boys under the age of 18. So gaming takes up sort of certainly a not insignificant part of the cultural consciousness, right? Like, we have gaming devices in our pockets now that are thousands of times more popular or more powerful than things that we had even 30 years ago. And games are top of mind for a lot of people, and students are certainly included in that. So, so I think they're potentially a very rich source for mathematical inquiry, if it's done right. That's all I want to really say about relevancy. I want to talk a bit about the value that games can have for learning. And here we'll get a little academic, but bear with me. I've got a couple slides with some academic jargon. The first term that I want to mention briefly comes from the National Research Council book, Adding It Up, Helping Children Learn Mathematics. They talk about these sort of five different strands of sort of mathematical thinking. One of them is productive disposition, which is a habitual inclination to see mathematics as sensible, useful, and worthwhile, coupled with a belief in diligence and one's own efficacy. So this is not really sort of, about content in a sense. It's more about helping students self-identify as people who can think mathematically and who can problem solve and do that sort of critical analysis when they approach problems. I bring up this term because Keith Devlin, the author who I just talked about, wrote another book called Mathematics Education for a New Era, Video Games as a Medium for Learning, in which he talks about sort of designing what a video game might look like were it designed to also teach mathematics. I think part of the problem with educational games is that a lot of times they're not good educational resources, and they're also not very good games, and so they live in this sort of nether region. They're not really part of either world. So Devlin wrote a book sort of thinking about what that intersection might look like. And one of the things he talks about is productive disposition. So he writes about how important it is for students not only to learn content and learn sort of procedural skills, but it's also important for students to develop a particular identity, like he says, that of being at least a mathematically able person and possibly even a mathematician. Devlin goes on to argue that a productive disposition is the single most important outcome to aim for in a K-12 mathematics education. So he believes very strongly and argues very strongly that productive disposition is sort of a core tenet of what we should be aiming for. I hope to convince you over the course of the next 40-ish minutes that games can be a really fruitful avenue towards developing that productive disposition. One more bit of academic jargon. semiotic domain. So this is a term I first learned about in a book called What Video Games Have to Teach Us About Learning and Literacy from a man named James Paul Gee, who I believe was a linguistics professor, I think, in San Diego. And he didn't get into games until he was, I think, in his 60s thereabouts, because his grandson was really into video games and he wanted to, you know, be able to talk to his grandson about what he was doing in these games. So he started playing in his retirement. And so in this book, he talks about a semiotic domain, which is basically any, it's a very broad definition, any set of practices that recruits one or more modalities to communicate distinctive types of meanings. I feel like this definition is more helpful by way of example, right? So any sort of community of people who share a common interest can be thought of as a semiotic domain, including people who are interested in cellular biology, postmodern literary criticism, first-person shooter video games, high fashion advertisements, Roman Catholic theology, modernist painting, midwifery, rap music, wine connoisseurship, and certainly mathematics can be thrown in there as well. Guy talks a lot about semiotic domains and how when we think about whether or not something is worth learning, whether or not something is a waste of time or not, we need to be asking questions about the semiotic domains themselves. So he writes that if we're concerned with whether something is worth learning or not, whether it is a waste of time or not, video games or anything else, we should start with questions like the following. What semiotic domain is being entered through this learning? Is it a valuable domain or not? In what sense? Is the learner learning simply to understand or read in parts of the domain, or also to participate more fully in the domain by learning to produce or write meanings in the domain? And we need to keep in mind that in the modern world, there are a great many more potentially important semiotic domains than just those that show up in typical schools. I think what he's saying there is that when we talk about sort of looking at games from a learning perspective, the question of whether or not games are a waste of time is sort of it's a bit too simplistic, and that we need to be looking more critically at sort of the community around what students are participating in, and take a look at how students are participating within that community. And I think this ties into those previous slides on productive disposition as well, because these semiotic domains are not sort of isolated from one another. They all sort of intersect in interesting ways, right? Like if you are learning about mathematics in high school, for example, then it's likely that you're probably interested in computer science or physics or chemistry or some other domain like that. And so these domains all sort of intersect with one another in interesting ways. And so the question of whether or not games are a waste of time becomes a question of sort of what semiotic domain are we talking about and what other semiotic domains does it touch on? And I'd like to argue tonight that when we talk about games and when we ask the right questions about games, we're not only talking about games, but we're also talking about really interesting mathematics as well. And we're talking about questions that can help students develop that productive disposition. So, I'll get off my soapbox for now. Let's develop our mathematical identities and explore some related semiotic domains. And that's all I'll say about the jargon. So like I said, for the rest of my time, I'd just like to look at a few examples. But maybe now would be a good time to pause and see if there are any questions that people have. I'll also save some time at the end, so don't feel like you have to get it in now. Yeah, I didn't see any either. All right, well, I'll keep going. Feel free to just throw questions in the chat as they come up. I might not get to them right away, but I'll try to throw in a few more pauses as we go. Okay, so let's look at some examples. Let's do the fun stuff. Sorry, my original slide deck, this is a video, but here it's just an image. Does anybody remember Draw Something? It was a super popular game for like a hot minute in the spring of 2012. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, sometimes when I give this talk to younger crowds, that I get a little bit of side eye when I talk about this game. So, yeah. So for those of you who don't remember, it's basically sort of an mobile game equivalent of Pictionary. So the way the game worked is you would connect with Facebook, and then you would just take turns drawing with your friends. And if it was your turn, you would get a selection of three words that you could choose to draw. So you would pick one, then you would draw it, and it would get sent to your friend. And then your friend would try to guess what you had drawn. And if they guessed right, then you all got coins or points or whatever. And then roles switched. So if I drew one round, then I would be guessing the next round, and then it would go back and forth. There was no end game state. You just kept drawing over and over again with your friends until you got sick of playing the game. So you can just think of it as a sort of mobile version of Pictionary, like Jessica said. And this game was super popular, like I said, for a period of time in 2012. The axes can be kind of hard to see here in this picture, but this covers like a 2.5 week-ish span in March of 2012, when the number of daily active users who were playing this game increased by a factor of 6 in a very short amount of time, from about 2 million daily users to over 12 million. So this game blew up really quickly. And hot on the heels of this massive growth, the company that made the game, OMG Pop, was purchased by Zynga for like over $200 million. Pretty big payday. But the game, for as popular it was, it wasn't without its faults. So you can see towards the end of March 2012, this article came out on this gaming website called IGN, which is called "Why Draw Something Blew Up But Might Fade Fast." And so the article sort of offered up some critiques of the game. The biggest one was the one I put in the slide here, which I'll just summarize. The author wrote, "Draw Something's word pool is too small, way too small. Anyone that consistently puts in time for even a few days will start seeing repeats. This breaks the game, plain and simple. And if you play as seriously as some editors around the IGN office, by now most words are repeats." cheaters too. Cheaters don't help. And so the author goes on to complain about this potential issue and then offers up a solution at the bottom that says, to keep the app's most ardent fans from moving on, Draw Something's word pool needs to be 5 times its current size. This article was a bit prophetic in a way, because soon after that purchase went through, Draw Something started sort of just seriously shedding users. The scales here are not the same, so it's not as dramatic as it seems. But still, we went from over 14 million users to around 9 million over the period of a month from April to May. And that trend continued. About a year after Zynga bought that company, they shut it down. So it was a sort of flash in the pan. The game burned brightly, but it did not burn long. And so when I heard this news that Zynga had dropped a ton of cash on this company and then a year later shut it down, I got to thinking about to what extent that article was a fair critique and to what extent its proposed solution was a viable one. Certainly this, it's true anecdotally from my own experience. I played this game a lot when it came out. I was just reading the chat. I played this game when it came out, and over time I did start to see more repeats, and that did sort of lessen my appeal to the game. Over here, you can see an image on the left. The way the game was structured was when it was your turn, you got a card with an easy, medium, and a hard choice. So in this case, easy is Surfer, medium is Clog, hard is Famine. And word triplets always came together. So if Surfer was your easy word, Clog is always your medium word, Famine is always your hard word, which sort of restricted the game in a sense because you didn't get as much variety. Because you always knew how the words came together. And so over time, I stopped playing the game. So I began wondering to what extent a larger word pool would have helped. And I began wondering about that in particular with regards to a few different questions. So this is what I've put on the slide. So a quick sort of back of the envelope calculation based on sort of articles and guides for the game around the spring of 2012 suggests that 500-600 word triplets is a decent estimate for sort of how many words were in the game. So my question was, if you've played 10 rounds or 50 rounds or 100 rounds, any number of rounds, over time, what's the probability that you won't see any repeats? That was one thing I wondered about. Another thing I wondered about was, what's the expected repeat percentage, right? So maybe the probability of no repeats decays very quickly, but you see one repeat quickly and then you play a lot before you see a second repeat and then you play a lot before you see a third repeat. So maybe the expected percentage of repeats grows fairly slowly, which would be good for the developers. Another question I had is, how likely is your next round to be new over time, right? So when you first start out for your first round, it's 100% likely to be new. But what about when you get to your 10th round or your 50th round? How likely is that round to be new? So I was interested in these trends over time and also in how these trends grow with the number of triplets, right? So there was a suggestion that the word pool should be 5 times its current size. I'll spare you sort of the mathematical details. You're welcome to dig into these on your own. The probability of no repeats for you stats teachers out there, this is really just a reformulation of the birthday problem, which I'll talk about in a minute. But the probability of no repeats, when you first start out, right, you have 500 triplets, say, and they're all new. So you have a 100% likelihood that your first round is new. Fair enough, Jessica. Some people like the repeats. After your first round, now there are 499 triplets and that you haven't seen yet out of 500 total. So the probability that you don't see a repeat in your first two rounds is just the product of those first two terms here. And then it continues onwards. So for every new round, assuming you haven't seen any repeats yet, you have one fewer new card from the pool. And the word pool itself is always 500 words. 500 triplets of words, I should say. So after K rounds, you get this expression, which is a little bit gnarly. But if you plot it, you can see that the probability of no repeats craters really quickly. So, you know, it only takes you about 25-ish rounds before you have worse than a coin flip odds of seeing a repeat. And like I mentioned, this is basically just a reformulation of the birthday problem, which asks, you know, what's the minimum number of people you need in a room to have at least a 50% likelihood that two of them share a birthday, which I think is, I think the answer is 22 or 23, somewhere in there. So it's the same problem, and the result is surprisingly small. This trend, of course, doesn't depend on the fact that I had 500 here. If you change it to 1,000 or 1,500 or 2,000, you'll be able to nudge out this trend line a little bit, but this is sort of a mathematical boondoggle from which there's no simple escape. So you're bound to run into a repeat, and you're bound to run into a repeat relatively quickly. And this is true not just for draw something, but it's true for any game where you're drawing from a pool with replacement, right? So it's true of Pictionary or Trivial Pursuit or any game that's sort of inspired by like a game show. Like if you have Family Feud on your phone or a Jeopardy game or a Wheel of Fortune game or whatever, they'll all suffer from this, from what some people would argue is a sort of design flaw. But it's just sort of a mathematical inescapability. I'll talk less about the math for the other two. Here's some math up top, but I'm interested more in the trend. So the expected percentage of repeats grows sort of linear-ish. It doesn't grow too quickly, which is, I guess, a good thing if you're designing these games. But still, you know, it takes, I don't know, less takes after about 100 rounds, you can expect that about 10% of your rounds will have been repeats. And after 300 rounds, we're talking about, you know, 1 in 4 chance of, 1 in 4 of your rounds having been repeats, which for some people might be a deal breaker. I don't know. And 300 rounds may sound like a lot, but, you know, at its peak, if you were playing with 5 friends and you exchanged 2 or 3 pictures a day with each of those friends, then, you know, you could hit 300 total rounds in, I don't know, certainly a few weeks or a month or so. So from this perspective, maybe it's not so surprising that those daily active users numbers started to tank over a relatively short amount of time. Last one, how likely is your next round to be new? This one also decays. This decays exponentially. And again, the exponential decay has nothing to do with the fact that I had 500 in the denominator here. So if you replace that with 1,000 or 1,500 or 2,000 or whatever, you'll buy yourself a little bit of time. But again, this is a mathematical inevitability. The probability that your next draw is new will decay exponentially with the number of rounds you play. So in this case, like I guess you have to play about 350 rounds before you're worse than a coin flip. Your chances of getting a new round are worse than a coin flip, I should say. So these are sort of sobering trends if you are developing this game. And there are a couple ways you can sort of futz with it a little bit, right? Like you could maybe not draw with a replacement all the time or something like that. But unfortunately, if you're drawing with a replacement, these are the rules. And if Zynga had known that, maybe they could have saved themselves a few hundred million dollars. I don't know. Just a thought. Cool. I want to talk about, whoops. I want to talk about one more example in the time that we have. But let me, I don't think I saw any questions in here. If y'all have any questions, feel free to throw them in. Otherwise, I will keep it going. And like I said, I'll try to finish a few minutes early as well. So if you want to save questions for the end, we can do a little Q&A there too. Okay, let's keep going. One more example. This is a bit of an obscure title, sort of a deep cut from the Nintendo catalog. I don't know if anybody remembers this, but when the Wii came out in 2006, there were a bunch of channels you could download for the Wii. So they had like an internet channel and a Netflix channel, and the virtual console was its own channel where you could go buy old Nintendo games and things like that. And they also came out with this channel called Everybody Votes, which was just basically like a polling application. It wasn't really a game, although it had one game-like feature. The way it worked was you would go into the channel and you would see a bunch of survey questions. So the text is a little hard to read, but in the upper right, the survey questions are which is more romantic, chocolate or roses, and then I'd rather live in a house on ... or which century would you prefer to live in? So you would see a few survey questions. You could click on the survey question and you could vote for which answer you liked more. So that's what's happening on the lower left. I'd rather live in a house on. You can choose between a mountain or the beach. The one game-like feature was after you voted, you could then predict which response would win. So over time, you could build up this track record indicating sort of how closely your finger was to the pulse of what people preferred. So anyway, it wasn't totally a game. It had this game-like feature, but every poll was a choice between sort of one choice or another. Cool. It seems like some people remember it. Anyway, IGN reviewed this game. For some reason, all of my references to IGN in this talk are just people sort of poo-pooing different games. So the article on Everybody Votes was not super flattering. The biggest complaint was just all the poll questions are restricted to two answers. It's a this or that sort of choice. So I won't read this whole thing to you, but the one thing I do want to highlight is that example of the poll question, where would you rather live? The reviewer wrote, you might be a bit let down to see there are only two answers, beach or mountain. Nintendo, what's the dealio? What if I want to live in a cave, in the wilderness, in the city, under the sea, or in a van down by the river? Can my choice not be heard too? Which, you know, some would argue is a fair critique. It is certainly not very expressive when you have only two choices. But I think a counterpoint to that is that if you are going to design a system where you're allowed to choose between more than two choices, then the process of aggregating those votes becomes more complicated in that it's not necessarily so the nice thing about having two choices is that one of those choices is guaranteed to have a majority of the vote at the end of the day, but that's no longer true when you allow for more choices. So then the question becomes, how do you determine a winner? Do you just say that the winner is whoever got the most votes, even if you have sort of, even if you have 100 choices and one person wins with 2% of the vote? Or do you design some other way to tabulate votes based on how people are voting? So this raises a lot of questions for me about sort of the way we vote. The way that we vote in most parts of the country, at least for sort of local offices or state offices, is by plurality, which is where, you know, you have some candidates on the ballot and you vote for one of them and whoever gets the most votes wins. But there's a lot of sort of sort of criticism of that voting system. And these critiques come from a website called rangevoting.org, which advocates for voting system reform. And they really don't take kindly to plurality. They say if you were trying to design the worst way to vote, you might force voters to say the least possible amount, name just one candidate, and say nothing about how much you like or dislike any of the others. Make it reward voters for not voting for whom they really want, which is something I think we've all experienced, right? You typically vote for one of the two major party candidates, even if neither one of them really sort of aligns the closest to your values, because you know that if you don't vote for one of the two party candidates, your vote's not going to go to a winning candidate anyway. And then also make it operate over time in such a way as to diminish your number of choices to the minimum, only two or one, meaning no choice at all. So plurality voting sort of fosters this reinforcing feedback loop where third party candidates sort of can't get a leg up, right? Third party candidates never do well. And so then people never vote for them, which causes them to not do well, which causes fewer people to vote for them, and so on and so on. So that's sort of just the deal. That's the state of affairs with a lot of the way voting systems are structured around the country. But plurality isn't the only way to vote. So there are other ways that we could tabulate ballots in elections. There are many, many, many different voting systems. I'm not going to talk about them all, but I do want to highlight a few. Plurality is the one we probably are most familiar with. Here are a couple of alternatives. So one of them is the board account, which is sort of a point-based system. So let's say there are five candidates. You rank your candidates from one to five on the ballot, and then your first place vote gets 5 points, your second place vote gets 4 points, your third place vote gets 3 points, and then 2 points, and your last place vote gets a single point. So you get points based on the rankings, and whoever gets the most points wins. That's more straightforward than instant runoff voting. Instant runoff voting, actually, from a practical standpoint, is one of the more popular alternatives. It's used all over the place here in the Bay Area. But unfortunately, it's also one of the most confusing alternatives and results in many more spoiled ballots because people just think they understand the voting system, but then they fill out the ballot wrong, and so their vote can't be counted. Anyway, so with instant runoff voting, again, let's say there are five candidates, you rank them first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and then the votes are tabulated, and whichever candidate got the fewest first place votes is eliminated. And those ballots then go to everyone's second place candidate. So let's say I voted for candidate A, but candidate A was super unpopular and very few people voted for candidate A. Then in the first round, candidate A would be eliminated and my vote would then go to candidate B or whoever my second place vote was. Okay, so yes, there was a Mathalicious lesson inspired by voting reform. So I want to go through a quick thought experiment. I don't want to take a ton of time to go through the math. But let's imagine that Nintendo decided to bring back that Everybody Votes channel and that they decided to, let people choose from more than two choices. So maybe they do this and one of their prompts is, which console manufacturer is the best, Microsoft, Nintendo, or Sony? So they open this poll. They let people rank Microsoft, Nintendo, and Sony first, second, and third. And here are the votes that come back. So Microsoft outranks Nintendo, which outranks Sony for 45 votes. Nintendo is preferred to Sony, is preferred to Microsoft for 15. Sony is preferred to Nintendo, is preferred to Microsoft for 30. And Sony is preferred to Microsoft, is preferred to Nintendo for 10. I'm a little tight on time. Typically, I let people do a little bit of arithmetic here and determine who would win with each of these three systems. Spoiler alert, each company wins under a different system, which, if you take a step back, is a little bit of a bummer, right? It seems like we're inputting the same voting information to each of these systems, and we're getting a different output from each one, which can be a little bit demoralizing. It seems like maybe the way that people are elected has less to do with the will of the people and more to do with just the system that's used to tabulate the votes. But on the other hand, maybe the outcome is this way because one of these systems is just better than the rest. And so it's okay that these systems come out with different winners because two of these systems are bad and one of these is good, and we should just use the good one and not use the bad ones. So if you want to make that argument, though, you have to be able to define what a good voting system is and what a bad voting system is, right? And so in the theory of voting, there are a number of properties that you might want a voting system to have. I'm not going to talk about all of them. But three of the most common ones are these three. Two of them are easy to define. One of them is not. You can probably guess which one is not. The first one is unanimity, which basically just says that if everybody prefers candidate A to candidate B, then in the final ranking, A should come out ahead of B, right? So if everybody prefers candidate A to candidate B, there's no way that B should be able to win the election, for example, because everybody preferred A to B. Non-dictatorship is also relatively straightforward. It is what it sounds like. There's no individual who can basically set the result of the election, right? So I can't put in my ballot and have my ballot be what the final outcome of the election is. The tabulation can't be as simple as just pick this person's ballot and that's what the outcome is. That last one, though, called the independence of irrelevant alternatives, is a little bit trickier to define. I like to define it by way of this example that comes from the book Gaming the Vote, which is about voting systems. So there's this NBA professor who once was in a diner ordering dessert, and he was told that there were two types of pie, apple and blueberry. And so given the choice between apple and blueberry, he chose apple. The waitress goes, takes his order, comes back a few minutes later and says, "Oh yeah, we also have cherry." "In that case," said Morgan Besser, "I'll have the blueberry." Which if you stare at this anecdote for a minute, it should seem totally ridiculous and irrational. His preference between apple pie and blueberry pie shouldn't depend on whether or not cherry pie is there or not, right? It would make sense for him to switch from apple to cherry, but not from apple to blueberry. So this is called the independence of irrelevant alternatives. Our preferences between two candidates, A and B, shouldn't depend on whether or not there's a third candidate who's also on the ballot. Unfortunately, all of the systems we've looked at so far fail this independence of irrelevant alternatives, which is sometimes more colloquially referred to as the spoiler effect. So if you revisit these examples and crunch the numbers again, you can see that with every system, one company wins, one company acts as a spoiler, and one company would have won had the spoiler not been present. So for example, with plurality, that's the easiest one to tabulate. Microsoft has a plurality of the votes, 45 first place votes. But if Nintendo weren't there, Sony would have had 55 first place votes and Sony would have won. So Nintendo is acting as a spoiler in this election. With border count, the roles are sort of flipped around, but the idea is the same. Sony acts as a spoiler, Nintendo wins, but Microsoft would have won. And with IRV, it's similar. Sony wins, but without Microsoft, Nintendo would have won. So, I mean, it's a bit contrived, this example, in some sense, but in another sense, it's also deeply troubling. The fact that all of these systems seem to be equally bad from the standpoint of these properties that we might want a voting system to have. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. A man named Kenneth Arrow proved in the 50s that, in fact, any ranked choice voting system can't satisfy all three of those properties. So if a ranked choice voting system satisfies unanimity and independence of irrelevant alternatives, it must be a dictatorship. For which I believe he was awarded a Nobel Prize in economics. But it's a depressingly named theorem. It seems to suggest that in some sense, all voting systems are terrible. And every 4 years, you typically see an article to that effect. So this was in Slate last year. Voting is mathematically flawed. Before we despair too much, I'd like to just quickly point out that there is an escape from this result. And all of the systems we've talked about so far are ranked voting systems. You rank candidates from first to last. But that, too, has limitations in terms of expressiveness because you can't indicate a degree of preference. You can't say, I love my first place choice and I hate everyone else. You also can't indicate indifference. So you can't say, I don't know, I feel the same about everyone. I don't pay attention to these things. But there are voting systems that allow you to indicate those sort of degrees of preference. And if you've ever used Yelp, or if you've ever used Amazon, or until recently, if you'd ever used Netflix, I guess still with Netflix, but we'll get into that. You would have seen examples of what are called cardinal voting systems, where instead of ranking candidates, you rate them on a fixed scale. So score voting is one example of this. Each candidate is scored on some scale. So you say, you know, I give this candidate a 0, I give this candidate a 4. The numbers on the scale don't really matter. But the higher the number, the more the approval. The simplest implementation of this is called approval voting, which is like score voting, but it's just 0 or 1. It's a binary. So either you approve of a candidate or not. Another way to think of approval voting is it's just like plurality voting, except instead of voting for one candidate, you vote for one or more. You vote for everyone who you would approve of. One thing that's nice about approval voting is that, and score voting, they satisfy all three of those criteria. So they don't fall under the umbrella of Arrow's impossibility theorem. Approval voting, I won't talk too much about this, but the second point I think is worth mentioning. It never hurts to vote for your favorite candidate. So you can always approve of some third-party candidate who you know won't win and also hedge your bets by voting for a major party candidate who you think is more likely to win. So that is a property of a voting system that is certainly not a guaranteed property. Very quickly, I just want to highlight the fact that mathematicians are also trying to sort of model these different voting systems computationally to figure out sort of which one leads to the least regret in the society. So I'm not going to talk about these models too much because I want to save some time at the end. But very roughly speaking, this graph shows satisfaction increasing along the x-axis. The bars, the left end of the bar is satisfaction if voters are strategic, and the right end of the bar is satisfaction if voters are honest. So the group always does better when voters are honest, even though voters typically aren't. And these cardinal voting systems like approval voting and score voting do much, much better than things like plurality voting or instant runoff voting. In fact, the gap in satisfaction between plurality and approval voting is as big a gap as the gap between just having a random winner and plurality, which is sort of like the transition from no democracy to democracy, which I find pretty interesting if you buy into these models, which I've given you no reason to because I haven't really talked about them. But this is just a chart I find interesting. Last thing I want to mention is when it comes to games, right, like getting voting reform actually implemented in practice in our government is a huge, arduous task. But game developers aren't beholden to these same sort of requirements, right? They can just like do whatever they want. And so Little Big Planet offers an interesting example of this. And Little Big Planet, this was a game for the PlayStation. Well, it's a series of games now, but the first one came out in 2008. And it's a platforming game. You can run around in these levels and jump and collect bubbles and stickers and things like that. But it also comes with a bunch of level editing features. So people could build their own levels and then share them with the community. And so when the first game came out, you could rate different levels. You could give them a star. You can give them 0 stars or 5 stars. That's what you see in this first image in the upper left. This level had 4 stars on average from people who had played the level and rated it. But over time, the developers simplified this system. So by the time the second game came out in 2010, I think, they'd gotten rid of stars. And it was still score voting, but just on a simpler scale, basically -1 to 1. So you could give a level a sad face or a happy face. But over time, that system also evolved. The developer said that, you know, a lot of kids build levels in this game and they get bummed out when their levels have a bunch of sad faces next to them. So they got rid of sad faces and happy faces, And the only thing you could do to a level was like it. So sort of like what you can do on Twitter now with tweets. And liking is just an implementation of approval. Sorry, reading the chat again. Approval voting is, this is just an implementation of approval voting, right? Because you can like as many levels as you want, and that's an indication of your approval of that level. So I thought this was a really interesting example of sort of in the wild, a more robust voting system sort of getting simplified over time into approval voting. And something similar is happening lately with Netflix. If you noticed, right, there was a big brouhaha earlier this year because Netflix got rid of their star ratings and moved to a simple thumbs up, thumbs down. One of the reasons why they said they did that is that they get more data. You may have had some decision fatigue with star ratings, right? Trying to decide, wait, is this a 3-star restaurant on Yelp or is it 4 stars? I don't know. Some people just throw up their hands and don't rate at all. But when Netflix moved to thumbs ratings, they saw a 200% increase in ratings activity. And the developers of Little Big Planet said something similar, that with a simpler system, they get effectively higher turnout. So I just thought those were interesting examples. I'm going to finish up here. A couple thoughts before I close. These are just a few examples, right? There are plenty of other examples in a bunch of different fields. Computer science is pretty rich. There are a lot of academic papers that explore games. There's some research in cognitive science and games. A lot of people in artificial intelligence research will use games to build and test AIs. There are examples from physics. And around the world, there are also schools now that are sort of bringing games-based learnings to the forefront. So that's this article here in the lower right sort of highlights that. So why games? Games have a precedent. Games are relevant. Games have value for learning. I'll throw a couple links in the chat in just a minute. I don't have a list of all of the links I've talked about, but I do have most of them. One bit of shameless self-promotion. I also spent a few years thinking about this stuff a lot and wrote a book on it recently. So you can see these examples in there. There are some other examples as well. So I think I will stop there. Let me just throw some links in the chat. And let me also say thank you all for coming. I hope you enjoyed it. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them now.
That was awesome, Matt. Thank you for sharing.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right. So it looks like we don't have any questions. So I'm going to wrap it up for us. So we appreciate you, Matt, for taking the time out of your evening to share your presentation with us. And everyone that did attend, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Next week, just so you know, at the same time, same bat channel, we have Implementing Effective Mathematics Teaching Practices with Peg Smith. It says, this webinar will focus on the 8 effective mathematics teaching practices identified in the Principles to Actions and engage participants in a subset of activities from the new Taking Action series. So it sounds really interesting. So we'll be back here next Tuesday. And looking for that next Tuesday. And I think that's it. So if there are no questions, I am going to end our recording. And if you remember, this will be made available typically at the max within 24 hours. Typically, it's a little bit faster than that. So thank you, everyone, for attending. And have a great rest of your evening. Okay, everybody, I have stopped the recording.